And when you know that you're a seven-figure person, that doesn't mean it comes from a job. It comes from a way of thinking. See, being wealthy and being poverty is a mindset. And once you let that mindset go and you adopt a new mindset, that's who you become. It doesn't matter when it happened. It's going to happen because it's always about the mindset. As the mind changes, your world changes.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Executive Health and Life. I'm your host, Julian Hayes II, back at it again, as I always say, with another fascinating guest and another limitless individual. And today we are talking about thinking big, attracting opportunities into our life that others maybe thought were a pipe dream. Today we're talking about rebuilding, reinventing yourself. Simply put, we are talking about becoming limitless. But to do that, we first have to check our life. And my guest today, Dr. James Arthur Williams, is someone who embodies all of these things. He's someone who has completely changed his life. You know, he's an associate professor at the University of Tennessee. Shout out to UT, the best university.
Good balls.
And he's the owner and CEO of Unmask Your True Potential, along with being an author and a sought-after speaker. He's spoken in many countries. Some of these include Korea, China, Bulgaria, Spain, France, and Canada. Some of the companies and organizations he's spoken at: James Madison, Marriott, Vanderbilt, Farley Dickerson, Pigeon Forge, Chamber of Commerce, and so many others. He's a great and inspiring human being, first and foremost, and most importantly. So without further ado, my man, James, how's it going today?
Pretty good, man. I appreciate that. It's like, I appreciate you making me sound like I'm so important or good, man. Thank you. I appreciate it. Now, I'm doing very well, man. Every day I have an opportunity to wake up and try to give out a little bit of positive love that could bring us all together to unite us. It's a great day.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had to, besides all the awesome accolades and the awesome human being you are, after all, an associate professor at the University of Tennessee.
That's right.
You know, so I had to get someone. You're the first one on here. So this makes me proud to finally have someone on here. So
hey, I'm excited to be here. Seriously, I appreciate you, Julian.
Yeah. And so, you know, I want to start off with just, you know, when we first got connected, we talked about sitting courtside and you were watching LeBron. Now, I remember I wasn't courtside, but I did see LeBron play when he was with Miami and he absolutely destroyed my Sixers. That was in Philly. It was awful, but it was a fun game. This was the process Sixers. And so tickets were really cheap. Yeah. It was good for me because I was in medical school. And but just the sheer size of those guys. But then I couldn't help to see the people on the floor, courtside. Yeah. And I was just thinking, what did those people do? So how was your experience at courtside?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm a big-time LeBron James fan. I've been following him since he's been in high school. I'm a person that grew up with Michael Jordan, and I get my friends attacking me because I feel like LeBron is the best. That's just my opinion. It's all subjective. I would say that. But to see the size of them, it was so many different things that was going on, right? To realize I'm able to afford and be in a position, a person that came from poverty, to be able to have my family at this game and to sit so close. And then you see the people that's like right there beside him. You're like, wow, what do they do for a living? And people are looking at you. And I realize there's all levels to it. So you got people that's in the nosebleeds looking at you. What does it take to you to get there? But people in my position may be saying, what are these people doing that's sitting beside them? But then you had the players on the court looking and saying, I wonder what do they do to be able to afford to be in the game? And then I'm looking at the players, look at the Hornets mascot do these amazing tricks, and they're excited by it, or they're excited by watching the dance team. And I realize all of us have these unique abilities that somebody look at and aspire to be like or are inspired by, you know, regardless of what we, you know, what we put these people up on a pedestal. So it was just, it was fascinating to see all of those things. But to hear my daughter say, Dad, I'm so inspired by the fact that you can just spend money and it's not a big thing to you. And I said, I want you to realize this, though. Your brothers and sisters see your apartment here in Charlotte and they're like, wow, I want to be like Big Sis. I said, so people are always looking at each other and it's all about us creating this positive impact and just trying to say, how can we get everybody to find some level of joy or success in this world, whatever it is for them, and be able to appreciate it and not think that we're better than anybody else. One is superior and the other is inferior. So it was a lot of those thoughts that was going on in my mind. And it was exciting just to be able to see a guy that, you know, I support, to see him in real time jump and move like that at the age of 39. I think all of those things was going on in my mind.
Yeah, it's amazing to see that someone has been in the league at a top level for 20 years. And, you know, even no matter how you feel about him, I have to commend him also for, you know, whether you're a CEO or a top speaker, entrepreneur, you're in the public eye a lot. And to be a family man, have all these arrows pretty much shooting at you all the time, no scandals or none of that, that's a major thing right there. That's a major thing.
Absolutely. I agree with you completely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So speaking at levels, you know, present day, you know, I read 6 college degrees, 2 doctorates, professional football, 4 books, I believe, speaking around the world, in shape, healthy, beautiful looking family, tenured at a major university. However, as we all know, it was not always like this. So no. I want to backtrack a little bit and I want to talk to young James, which I'm pretty sure listeners are going to probably see very quickly that this ain't the guy that we're talking to right now. So let's go back there.
Yeah, man, it's crazy because it's like even psychologically to go back there, a lot of times you realize like how in the world, you know, did God, the universe get me to the point to where I am now, man. So I think a lot of times, you know, I grew up, my name was James Cremel. My biological father, you know, decided to step away and sign over his rights. And then my stepdad, when my mom remarried, decided to adopt us. But it was never really a conversation about it. It was just, you know, hey, your real dad decided to sign over his rights. You got this amazing dad here. You know, he wants to adopt you. And we all was like, yeah, man, he's a great guy. Let's do that. And he did everything that was right as a father. Was great. Introduced us to a relationship with God and all of these things. But in the back of my mind, it was always like, yo, why do my biological father not want me? So, and I think what happened is it leaves a void in you and you find yourself chasing something. So I was always chasing to be appreciated and be wanted in this world. And I think my mother, you know, at the time, she didn't really know how to address that or to give me that. So I was looking for something in my mother that I never really got. So I found it in women, you know, but you, when you're chasing it in something else, you never feel truly satisfied or at peace. And it's like, You sleep with a woman or you try to impress people, and it's just you're happy for a little bit and then you go back to feeling low. So for a long time, it was chasing girls, getting in fights in school, getting suspended from school, in school suspension, Saturday school detention. You know, you name it, every suspension I had. And we was living in Fall River, Massachusetts, where it was predominantly white. So we didn't really see, you know, color. We just saw that we was all poor living in this environment. You know, then when my dad get out of the Navy and we move back to North Carolina, it's predominantly black and we move into a more segregated neighborhood. But it was something that we never quite bought into because what we grew up for our foundation was, you know, these white brothers and sisters, these are my people. So it was hard for us to really buy into a lot of the prejudice and stereotypical beliefs because we just wasn't used to that. And then we end up being athletes, you know, and then I was a class clown in class, you know, and you get into trouble. So everybody is kind of, you know, you have this false love to where people, hey, what's up, James? So you think you're cool and popular, not realizing that I'm just putting myself more and more into this person that's completely foreign to who I am. So I started wearing this mask of being a thug, you know, and I wanted people to really see this person and think this person was impressive. And it got me to where I started having sex at 13, had 2 kids by the time I was 17. I sold crack. I sold marijuana. Ended up been a great athlete and went to college, but couldn't get a Division I scholarship because of my GPA. And then when I got to my Division III school, you know, and when I was in 1998 to 99, I was depressed, man. Like, I should be starting. I wasn't starting. So I started hanging with the Bloods and almost shot somebody. And that's when I said, I need to change my life. So I decided to join the Air Force. And when I joined the Air Force, man, it was like, I'm going to come in and I'm not going to be J-Rock. I'm not going to be a football player. Anybody that could teach me how to be a better person, I'm going to do that. And I met my wife and my wife taught me how to love, you know, but I still didn't love myself. So I'm chasing all of these things. And eventually it led me to, you know, to cut a long story short, to figure out that all of these accolades, all these successes, they mean nothing if you don't learn to love yourself. So I had to learn to love myself by stripping myself away from religion, realizing religion was a way to divide me and separate me. But I found God in the process, like a real relationship with God. And once I was able to understand that, I got away from a lot of these rules in society that never really fed me. And it just led me on this path to where when I speak, I want to be like God. I am, you know, so whatever I say, I am limitless. I am, you know, the God of my universe. I am the king of my universe. It just gave me this power to where I felt like I'm going to do whatever I want to do and live a life that inspire other people to say, man, I could live that life too. So that's what, you know, to cut a long story short, that's how I got to where I am now. And I think it's more mental and psychological and spiritual than anything. And then I was able to start making the right actions.
Yeah, that's there's a lot I can go there. And you mentioned I am, and probably the last few years, you know, one of my mentorships, it's those are the two most powerful words that we can say is I am. And, you know, this brings me to the question now, and there's a lot of things, but I'm thinking with childhood. And, you know, some people, it becomes women, and that's where the validation comes from. Some people, it's maybe their body, just themselves. And then some people, it's maybe their career. But do you think that it's almost impossible to come out of childhood without one of these type of attachments and everything, no matter how good of parents you come from? What do you think about that?
You know, just from my personal experience and my interactions with other humans, because this is a human experience. Mm-hmm. None of us have lived it before. So Julian, I agree with you. I don't think nobody's going to get out of childhood, even if it seems like they have the perfect life, which I think a lot of times the so-called ideal of a perfect life actually masks you to a lot of the real truths. And what did the good book say? The truth shall set you free. Knowing who you are and knowing what you're up against, I think will free you from a lot of these things that really trap us and that, you know, that shackle us down to these beliefs. So I agree with you completely. And for me, it felt good being in my environment where the so-called thugs or the bad guys, they have the beautiful women. You know, so to be able to have beautiful women and to have girls that's willing to have sex with me, it made me feel good. It made me feel powerful. But the thing that they don't tell you is after the act, after the climax, you go back to like, yo, I feel lonely. I don't feel good. And then what happened is you start creating this desire of you need to always feel that because you can't feel it in yourself. But once you realize all of that is a lie, you don't need that, you know, and it doesn't fill you up. You know, so those are external things. So now when you really love who you are, you really build who you are, any of those experiences you have, they're even amplified because now it's more organic and it's more spiritual. And I think we don't get that in our childhood. We get a lot of people telling us what it looks like to be successful. So we start attaching ourselves to all of these things that sooner or later we realize it's not real. You know, and I tell people that, like, I work with people that was a dentist. I work with a guy that was a dentist, you know, and he hated his job. And people would be looking at him like, man, you a dentist, man. You a DDS. You're making a lot of money. You should be happy. And this is what this guy said to me. He said, nah, I'm not happy, man. I said, well, at least you know, you got kids and stuff like that. He said, yeah, I love my kids. I said, what about your wife? He said, she probably married me because I was a dentist. So you realize when you live a lie, your whole life become a lie. Mm. So the sooner you get close to saying, nah, man, let me be who it is that I am, everything become powerful, becomes real. And everything that you really want in your heart, those desires come to you. You know, people say, well, this is the only way I can make money. Skip Bayless was a journalist. Stephen A. was a journalist. They're making money. I think you got to find out what you really put on this earth to do, and then everything else will attract to you, and you'll be able to strip yourself away from the lies and stop being a charlatan, and you'll start really acting in your truth. So I agree with you.
You know, and there's so much truth with that. But the first thing is, you know, somebody can probably feel that right now of just like, man, I hate what I'm doing, or this ain't my truth, but, you know, things are pretty good right now, right? You know, and I think when we first connected, we talked about kind of being in the middle, right? You know, you're not at the very top to where you got this huge family standard and all this thing, but you're not at the very bottom where you just absolutely hate it and want to do everything to get rid of it. You got just enough to keep you right where you are. So what do you think's like the first step or two to start breaking free from that, to really step into your true I am?
You know, I'm going to say this, and it may not be popular to a lot of people. I think either you got to be very observant, mm-hmm. and see people that say, I don't want to be like that person. Or you got to really take this human experience and be willing to explore. I explored jobs. I explored women. I explored relationships. And I realized that's not who I am. So once you realize who you're not, you can go ahead and put that away and start working towards who you are. So I think by observing people, you say, look, I'm not a person that could adjust to living a homeless life. I'm not a person that want to live a life where I don't have a certain amount of money. It's a certain lifestyle I want. That's not who I am. So now I can start working towards who I am. And once you do that, you got to start thinking and envisioning who you are. And say, my people perish for their lack of vision. You got to have a vision. What is it that you see yourself being? And you got to see it so strong that you say, no, this is who I am. And once you start seeing that thought, you got to turn that thought into an action. And then the action becomes a daily practice that becomes a habit. And that habit eventually becomes a lifestyle or your personality. So I think it all begins in your mind, but a lot of times you got to put yourself in situations and say, you know what? I don't like the way I feel. That's not me. And I think a lot of times people think the church or people can fear you into doing right. Nobody can ever fear you into doing right. And I don't think the fear is even of God. God said, I didn't give you a spirit of fear. I gave you a sound mind. So to me, you got to really know who you are as a person and use love to challenge you. I love myself so much. I want to move in this direction because you have two emotions, love and fear. And I think you got to move into unconditional love, unconditional love for yourself. And then you can extend that out to other people.
Yeah. You know, and that reminds me, when I first got started with my health journey, it was more of the fear. I'm running away from something, right? I'm running away from illness and everything that runs in my family, right? And then along the way, you get to talking with people, you get to exploring, you get exposure, and you learn that actually, if I'm running towards something, that's much more powerful, much more powerful. So I started to run toward this thing, toward this optimal health, toward this limitless life, toward this human unlocking human potential, et cetera, instead of I'm just running away from something. Because one puts me still in a mind of scarcity, like it could be taken away. And the other one is much more abundant. So that leads me into the thing here is, so say I'm visualizing, right? I'm visualizing and I see this world in my head. But when I open my eyes, none of that's around, right? And that's the hard part, because that was the hard part for me, right? When I go into this space, right, I'm closing my eyes, I can just see everything, right? But then you got people around me that they don't see me as this person in my head. I go to my job, they don't see me as this person in my head. My bank account doesn't see me as this person. My body composition right now doesn't see me as that person. So, and I'm sure you had that stage too, right, where that old life is behind. But in this 3D world right now, it's still showing present, but in your head it's already different. How do you manage that part?
I'm gonna preface it with, I think Les Brown said this, you don't have to be great to get started, but you have to get started if you aim to be great. So it's not where you are, it's where you aim to be. I was just talking to my students today in class and I said, look, I remember having negative $75 in the bank. I remember looking at my check. And after working 2 weeks in the military, saying, how in the world, it's only $189, $200. Like, how can they do this? How can the child support just take the money away from me like this? And I just kept saying, one day it won't always be this way. One day it won't always be this way. And I told my wife, I said, one day you would not have to work. One day you won't have to work. I didn't know that it was going to take 15 years. But I put it out into the universe. Mm-hmm. I remember being at Stock Builder Supply, and I come in with my accounting book and I'm studying for my master's, and they're like, man, you got a master's degree, you making what I make, you make $9.15 an hour. And I said, I won't always be here. I said, I promise you that. I said, you look at me. I said, one day you're gonna see me on TV. And people thought I was joking. Said it when I was at BB&T. They thought I was joking, but I got messages in my inbox. Hey James, I saw you on TV doing this, man. When you said it, I thought you was crazy. I was like, man, I thought I was crazy too. So what I realized, speak it out into the universe. And I don't say I want. I say, no, I will. I will be a seven-figure person. I will be on TV. I will be the voice to the world. I will be, you know, because I am the voice of God. I am limitless. I truly believe this. So when I'm talking to people, I don't care how crazy they think I am. The feeling and the energy becomes contagious. And I think the more you put that out into the universe vibrates. And it's like all of a sudden God said, you know what? Hey, this dude crazy enough to believe it. He really wanted it. His faith without works is not dead because he's putting in the work. You know what? I'm going to give it to him. And everything starts opening up for you. I'm a firm believer in that. So even when you face that pain or you face the rejections, to me, I tell people, if I get 10 no's, I'm closer to a yes. So I don't look at anything as bad. I look at it as a great opportunity. Whatever closes, that's something even greater that's about to open. So it's all in how you create your paradigm. You know, and for me, my paradigm is like nothing bad ever happens. It's always pushing me towards something great. Jeremiah 29:11, God had plans to prosper me. And I don't even know how great they are. They're incomprehensible. So for me, it's always going to work out. It doesn't matter if I got so-called haters or people trying to stop me or situations. It's going to work out. I truly believe that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got a random question. You know, we talk about faith here, and people say, I'm going to hope and pray a lot, right? And just pray and pray and pray, and that's it. I forgot where I heard this from, but somebody was describing what true prayer is, and it was about to display that by doing the thing, being that person right now, before any of that is shown. That's what true prayer and faith looks like. What do you think about that?
I'm a firm believer in it, because I think, you know, God, the universe, whatever you want to call it, chi, it gives you signposts and it lets you know you're on the right way. It's like little things. You know, I tell people, I stopped biting my fingernails after 40 some years. And some people may say, oh, that's a small thing. Nah, man, it's been 7 weeks and I have no desire. I stopped eating sweets, you know, January 4th, 2023. And anybody that know me know that's huge. But what happened is that I believe when you truly want something from God, you say it, you envision it, you know it's going to happen. And then all of a sudden, God will give you little things. Like, I was at the jewelry store and the lady said, oh, I like your fingernails. I'm like, this is funny. I've never had a comment like this. Oh, okay, that's God telling me you're doing a good job. Or, you know, I meet somebody and they're like, yo, I just got a vision, man, that you're going to be one of the big, the sought out speakers, or the guy that created my website that did a phenomenal job. He said, God gave me the insight of how to create this website for you. Just wanted to do this for me. The guy that made the video said he felt like God inspired him to do that. That's everything in the universe telling me it's about to happen. Mm-hmm. It's about to happen. And you just got to keep pushing forward. So anytime it seemed like, okay, I was one step forward, somebody pushing me back, I'm like, nah, man, that's just a slingshot. You know, they just pulling me back. And when this is released, this is it. So I truly believe you just got to realize that your faith got to be so strong that it becomes a knowing. And as you move, as you talk, you know it's going to happen. You know, and that's where I'm at.
Yeah. So I, you know, going back to the family thing, right? You told your wife, you know, hey, you're not going to have to work one day. And it took 15 years. I'm sure with people, and maybe it's not even just their spouse, maybe it's family or just people around them, right? They got this thing in their head. They want to build this thing, right? And, you know, things take time. How do you, you know, oh, actually, you know, how do you, with family, how do you keep them on board with the vision as you're building, right?
You know, my background is leadership, so I believe that you got to inspire, share a vision. You know, so once you're selling them on this vision, you got to get them to see themselves in this vision. You know, when I'm telling my wife, hey, I'm spending money for this, or I'm doing this or that, I'm trying to paint the picture of this is what I'm trying to create. And it has you involved. It has the kids involved. It has the family involved. It has all the people that I'm trying to serve involved. You know, so the more your vision is shared and it's an inspired shared vision, I think the more people can buy into that. But also, I think people are watching you. You know, another example is to model the way. You know, but I'm always challenging the process. I'm asking them, so what do you think about this? What could be better? You know, then I'm enabling them to be a part of this journey, this dream. You know, so how do you feel in your heart? Like, you know, do you think this is something that people need? And then I'm constantly reevaluating the situation, you know, but while I'm doing this, I'm getting them to see that they're a part of this puzzle piece. This is not just me. And I'm getting them to feel my heart like this is what God really put on me. And I think what happens in that, you get to see who's really for you and who's against you. You know, and the people that's not supportive, I'm not telling you to isolate them out of your life. But if you feel like it's taking away your momentum or your mojo, you got to really start disassociating yourself with them or keeping them at a distance to where it's not taking away your inspiration or your fire. You know, but the ones that you do have that's supportive, you need to bring them close because you're going to need that energy. But I think you got to involve them in the process. And the more they're involved in it, the more they see how they're a part of it, I think it makes a big difference. But even when you do that with some people, they may not feel like they can help you. Just keep them in a loop of what's going on and why you're doing what you're doing, and let them know that this is a part of your purpose of why you're here on this earth. I think that's how I've been able to keep my family involved in it.
Yeah. And part of me thinks that sometimes, I think a lot of people want to feel like they're a part of something big, right? Some type of mission. Right. And I think that's the thing that you see a lot of times in the workplace, right? Like, well, what am I going here for 40 hours a week for? Like, why am I doing this? I'm getting a paycheck, sure, but there's really no sense of fulfillment, no greater purpose in this. Whereas I feel like when you share this with your family and your and people close to you, they start to see, oh, okay. And then you include them in there. And then maybe they even start to do something that they think could help you just because they feel like it more. So I don't know. I just feel like that's kind of what I'm hearing there and sensing at times.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of this requires big thinking. And what is, we talk about big thinking a lot, right? Think big, you know, all this stuff. But what does that actually look like to you?
Well, look, I'm going to tell you, I don't think, if you don't have a dream that's so crazy that you know that the only way it can happen is if God or some mysterious thing can kind of help you out, I don't think you're dreaming big enough. If you can do it, then to me, you know, how big is the dream? So I like to dream. So, and I think it comes from a place deep down inside. Like when I was telling people, my book will be turned into a movie. I just feel it. And I don't feel it is because of me. I feel it's because this is what the world needs. The world needs to see that, no, you know, we're all alike. We're together. All of these social constructs divide us. Our minds stop us from being what it is that we can be. You know, so that's what From Thug to Scholar, An Odyssey to Unmask My True Potential. Remove your mask and start living in your true potential and not your parents, not your teachers, not your pastors, not your church. What is it that you want to be? What is it that you want to do? You know, check your life, be limitless. It's about, this is your life. You only get one life as James, Williams, Julian, or whomever. What are you going to do with it? Or are you going to live somebody else's life? So these are things that I feel like the world needs. So I think when you understand your purpose and you understand that your purpose is also a shared experience with other people to make this world a better place, once you really believe in that, you feel like, no, this is something that got to be out there. So then I think my thinking becomes bigger because everything that I'm trying to do is bigger than me. You know, I'm trying to get my voice to the world because I want everybody to be living, you know, what their limitless life can be. I want everybody to remove the mask and walk in their true potential. This is things that I believe in. And I believe it's all mind, body, and spirit. You can have the body you want. You can have the mind you want. You can have the career, the money. You can have the family you want. I believe all of those things are true. You know, that's why I love the fact that if I take my shirt off, I got abs. You know, I'm 43 years old and it's like, oh, people can't have that. Yes, you can. And I know what it's like to have weight. I know what it's like not to see an ab at all. You know, so to show people that, no, you can do what it is that you want to do. You just got to believe. But if you tell me you can't do it, you can't do it. Mm-hmm. Because you're the only enemy that can stop you. You know, I tell people the enemy is the inner me. Whatever you feel on the inside could either stop you or propel you forward.
It's an inside out job. And a lot of times, whether you're seeking for abundance, acceptance, whatever, a lot of times we seek outside when really all that lies inside. So you're saying check your life, be limitless. What was the origin of that?
So it's funny. I don't know what came. So I was coming up with a TED talk and we was trying to figure out what was the title. And something just hit me like, yo, I don't believe in social constructs. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in black and white. I don't, you know, I'm looking at my phone. My phone is black, you know, right? Like this is black. I'm not black. And some, it may offend some black people. So how dare you say you're not black? And I'm saying that because I know why the word was created. It was created to show that we're inferior to white. And you don't have to question me. You just have to look at one thing that I asked my mom when I was a kid. You know, I was like, why is it black, white, and then Mexican, Asian? Like, how do we jump from color or race to ethnicity? Like, that doesn't make sense. So you realize the world was always between black and white. And if you buy into that, it limits you, whether you're white, whether you're black. But when you release yourself from it and say, oh, okay, I can identify in this world that I am black. I can identify, but in this esoteric realm, this spiritual world, I'm neither. I'm nothing. I'm limitless. I'm a spirit trying to connect with other spirits. I don't care what the avatar is. It could be white. It could be male. It could be transgender. It could be atheist. It could be whatever. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to your spirit. I'm trying to connect with you on a soul level. So once I said check your life, it's like check your limitations of whatever it is that you say you are and feel the discomfort. You should feel discomfort. It's going to create conflict within yourself, conflict with everything it was that you was taught to believe. Question everything. And once you question it and you're willing to say, I want to know the truth, Even if it makes me think differently, I want to know the truth. You'll be free. And you'll be free to be who you was really meant to be in this life before any snake, any serpent ever told you who you were. And then you'll be just like Adam and Eve in the garden when God, when they said, I'm naked. And God said, who told you that? Who told you that you was black? Who told you that you was white? Who told you that you was a female? Who told you that you was a Christian? These are man-made labels that limits you. But once you let them go, you're free to be who you was really meant to be. And that's what it means to check your life and be limitless.
You know, so when I hear that, that does create a lot of discomfort with a lot of people and probably causes a lot of conflict. And I think that's a good segue, actually, to what you are, I guess, known mainly for when you speak is that you empower executive leaders to lean into their discomforts and to use conflict as their superpower for this inclusive leadership. But before even probably the inclusive leadership part, I'm curious about how is this received with people when especially the part about, well, they're like, if I'm not black, then what am I? Or if I'm not just white, then what am I? You know, and so how do you, because I'm sure it causes a lot of cognitive dissonance with people.
It does, you know, but I tell people this, you know, tell me, why do you love your kids? And they're going to all of these things that I say, tell me how much you love your kids. And they'll keep talking. I'm like, if you truly love your kids, you can never really explain it. You can't really explain the unknown. Mm-hmm. You know, what makes you discomfort and the reason why it makes you discomfort is because there's a modicum in you that know that it's not true what you believe. But when you know what you believe, nobody can make you feel uncomfortable because you know who you are. If a person came up to me right now and said, oh, you're a clown or you're this or you're that, I wouldn't think anything. I would be wishing that this person could find peace. It wouldn't bother me. That's like, I'll give you another example. If I said, Julian, turn around, there's a ghost, you'll probably start laughing at me like, what's wrong with this guy? It wouldn't bother you at all. It wouldn't make you feel uncomfortable. But what about when we tell kids eventually, after lying to them for years, there's no Santa Claus? What does it do to them?
It shakes
their whole foundation, because that's all they knew all their life. And we told them that lie. Regardless of, we got it as, well, we just want them to be in the spirit, whatever the reason is, you created a lie. So you got to ask yourself, what if it's a lie that the world wanted you to buy into these social constructs because they wanted to divide us? What would happen if we didn't believe in social constructs? What if we just accepted people for who they are? And people would say, well, that's not possible. It is for babies. Toddlers don't know that they're black. Toddlers don't know that they're white. They don't know that they're a Christian. They don't know what their sexual orientation is. But I guarantee you, if I go to hug a Caucasian or a white baby or an Asian baby, and I show them love and joy, they'll hug me back. Guarantee they'll kiss me and not think anything of it. I guarantee if I feed them, they will take the food from me, because all they know is joy and survival and just being in a moment. Whereas now we become thinking beings and we're not in the moment, we're in our heads. So our heads tell us, stop talking to him because, hey, look at the way he dressed, he got tattoos, he may be such and such. Because all of these narratives that was created from what you watched on TV, what you listen to music, what people told you, what you learned at church, what you learned in school, all of these things are limiting you. And people will say, well, how does that work for you? I get to go to Bulgaria where I don't see people that look like me and I get nothing but love. I get to go to China where people don't look like me. I get nothing but love. But what if I was limited in my way of thinking? All Asians think like this, or all white people think like this. I wouldn't be able to be free and enjoy myself and enjoy these beautiful people that want to enjoy me. Because most people are inherently good. It's their flesh that they start feeding that becomes bad. The spirit is always good and it's always able and always willing. And I tell people like this, most people are not bad. They're just doing what they believe is right in their world. So that's the reason why I try to get them away from the social constructs. But I always try to relate it to Christmas and I relate it to babies, mm-hmm. just to get them to think.
Yeah, that's a lot to chew on, and it makes perfect sense, right? Because as part of it is, it's a way to be controlled. It's a way to limit yourself. And I always think, whether right or wrong, that why do they want me to stay inside this box when there's other people outside this box doing things? And so maybe it's a way to be controlled, right? Why do you not talk about, you know, financial literacy in school and stuff when it's important? And, you know, these are just questions to ask. And, you know, so that brings me to the thing that, okay, so when someone starts to check their life, they start to pretty much hold the mirror up to themselves. It's probably not going to be too favorable and that pretty, right? There's going to be a lot of discomfort. There's going to be a lot of maybe insecurities and things out there. And one of the things that happens then, and I know I used to, and sometimes it might still try to creep up, is separating your worth from what's your accomplishments, from maybe what you perceive as a limitation or something that you don't have. How do people go about separating those things?
I think it's tough because I think it creates this this duality. You know, if you achieve these things that the world tell you are great, then you're a success. And I say, well, maybe you're not. And people are like, well, what you mean? I say, okay, what if I told you I know a person that is a millionaire and they're miserable, and I know somebody that barely has enough food to eat and they enjoy life. People, how's that so? And I say, to me, the person that barely has enough to eat, they have mastered life. They're successful. So for me, it's about a mastery of life. And when I say a mastery of life, it's a mastery of self. Because once you master yourself, whether you have money or don't have money, you're able to find joy in it. You may feel a little uncomfortable in your flesh, but you're able to somehow find joy in it. And I feel like God or the universe allowed me to see all levels of it. I saw what it was like not to have. I saw what it was like to have. I saw what it's like to consider walking away from a six-figure job, the first six-figure job that I had, because I felt like I wasn't respected in that position. And what I realized is, James, as long as you're happy with you and you know who you are, I know the world need to hear what it is that I got to say. I know that I'm just an extension of God. I know that. And I know that regardless of what happened in this job or whatever, I'm always going to be taken care of. And when you know that you're a seven-figure person, that doesn't mean it comes from a job. It comes from a way of thinking. See, being wealthy and being poverty is a mindset. And once you let that mindset go and you adopt a new mindset, that's who you become. It doesn't matter when it happened. It's going to happen because it's always about the mindset. As the mind changes, your world changes. So I believe success, when I became successful, when I know that for a fact, there are people that talk about me that I love to death. I love them. And I know the things they have done. I know the things they have said. And in my flesh, it's like, man, why would they do that? Like, I don't understand that. But in my spirit, it's like, hey, they're doing what they're supposed to do. Because if it makes them happy, if it gives them some limited amount of joy or success, hey, do what you do. We just have two different goals that create static. So I can disassociate with you and I can love you from afar, but I don't hate them. I don't have no ill will towards them. And I think once I was able to have the emotional intelligence to realize that even in the spite of people wanting the worst for me, or even if they wanted to kill me like Jesus, they know not what they do because they don't know who I am. You know, so that's where my mindset is. And to me, that's when I became a success. So all of the awards, all of the accolades, the money, all of that, I don't really look at it as success. The way I think is when I became a success.
Why do you think conflict is such a superpower? Because it's something that typically people are going to avoid at all costs, even if it means making themselves sick or stress and et cetera and et cetera. They'll never go toward conflict. So why do you actually encourage us to actually lean into conflict?
Because I think about all of the arguments I have with my wife. I think about the disagreements I have with my parents, the disagreements I have with my brothers, the disagreements I had even with my kids or colleagues or things of that nature. And what I did was become aware of how it made me feel every single time I engaged in it. And then what did I look at in myself that I didn't like? I might didn't like that I raised my voice, might didn't like that I used profanity, might didn't like that I said things that I wish I didn't say. And I just sat in it. And I said, all right, I get an opportunity next time that I'm going to be calm. And there's going to come a time where somebody is going to say something that normally would, that would make me fly off the handle, and I'm going to sit in complete peace. Because there's only three things that I'm anchored in: unconditional love, joy, and peace. So I'm going to give unconditional love eventually to this situation. So every time I fail, I feel like what they said in the Bible: when you fall, get up and go again. Get up and go again. And I don't look at myself like, ah, man, look at you. You're doing this again. I'm like, I failed again. Okay, next time I'll be ready. Next time I'll be ready. So every time I just use it as, I'm going to be better next time. So there were some times that I would find a way to say things that may agitate me if my somebody respond a certain way, just to see if I had arrived yet. And I failed the test again. And then it came a day where I was like, man, I feel nothing. And I was like, wow, this is the peace that I think Yeshua, Jesus, was talking about. I got it. And once I got there, it was no fear of, could I lose my wife? Could I lose my parents? Could I lose this? I was like, I don't need nothing. And once you get to that point where you're like, I don't really need anything in this world, these are things that I want. Only thing I need is my relationship with God and my understanding of self. I became super powerful. And I think the only way I found it was through conflict. So that's why I try to encourage people to lean into it, because most people circumvent it. And what happens is you keep building up that anger, the anger, the anger. And then sooner or later, it becomes a breaking point and you explode. And that's how we get murder. That's how we get assaults. That's how we get people fired on their jobs. But what if you lean into all of those little conflicts? You're getting stronger. You're getting stronger and stronger every single time. And I look at it as a great opportunity to become the best version of yourself. So that's why I encourage people to lean into conflict.
You know, and this is just a very side tangent. I don't even listen to that much rap and hip hop anymore. But when you said needing nothing, right? And Nas, one of his lyrics was, needing nothing attracts everything. And that lyric stuck out to my head so much. Needing nothing attracts everything. You know, and
it's facts. look, it's the gospel. You become more attractive.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it, right? Like, I read a book called The Art of Seduction. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're in school, you could chase the female, and the female may not like you. And I'm talking from a heterosexual perspective. And then all of a sudden you start dating somebody and you have no desire for it. All of a sudden now, sometimes 9 times out of 10, that female start looking at you a little differently. But what happened is you stop caring about them and you put your energy somewhere else. You become more attractive when you're not always feeling needy. But when you know that I am the value. And what I had to realize is, why just because you're beautiful, I should sleep with you? Like, who are you? I'm me. You know what I mean? I work hard for this body. I work hard for this mind. What make you think you deserve me? So now it's a choice, whatever you choose to do. And you walk with that power and people feel it. They have to feel the energy. So that's why I think it's, you become much more attractive when you stop chasing things. And it's kind of like when you used to play tag when you was younger. You run around, tag, you're it. By the time you get to the person, you're tired. But when you step back, the art of war, and you let your enemy come to you, it's much more rewarding when you capture them or you set them up. So to me, it's always best to walk in your royalty or your godliness and let things come to you. Never, ever chase anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely on that. You know, I was going through your Instagram a little bit just and one thing stuck out to me was you talked about not succumbing to the power of the inner train. Right. And I got to thinking about controlling our thoughts and how that, you know, pretty much what's going on in there is eventually what's going to manifest on the outside. So how do you go about controlling your thoughts and controlling that inner train?
I'm a big believer in meditation. I'm a big believer in being mindful, you know, so, and you can do that when you eat, when you talk, are you really engaged in the moment, disconnecting from social media. You know, I have a social media presence, but I put time limits on it. I put 15 minutes on each app so that I'm not on longer than that. And I don't listen to music no more. I heard you say you don't listen to rap music. And when I say I don't listen to music, I used to use, you know, I'm in the gym about 2 hours. I'm in my car maybe an hour out of the day. So that's like 3 hours of just music. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there like, yo, I don't think it's good to me to be listening to, yo, these hoes ain't loyal. Like, I don't think that's good. I like you, Chris Brown, but I shouldn't be listening to this all the time, 24/7. Or, you know, when I ride on my enemies by Tupac. Like, why am I riding on my enemies? I'm a professor. Like, what am I doing? Right? I don't think it's good to listen to that. So I said, James, you got to be more mindful of what you're putting in your mind. So all I listen to now when I go to the gym is books or podcasts. And it's all about things about spirituality or you know, mindfulness or leadership. So I feed my mind with what it is that I want to become. And so I'm very protective of that because I realize when you put things in there, all of those subliminal messages, you start acting out on things, you're more agitated. Like I become even more calm in my spirit by what it is that I feed my mind with. You know, so I think you got to be very protective of that. So I'm a big believer in meditation, mindfulness, and what you're putting in your mind.
No, that's one of the reasons why I stopped listening to to pretty much rap and hip hop, right? There's a frequency to music, right?
Yes.
And there's a certain time period throughout history where the standard frequency of music changed because frequency of music elicits different types of emotions in us. I know it sounds crazy. It sounded crazy to me when I first heard it and I started reading it and you can't unsee it. So, you know, for me, when I do my runs and stuff, I listen to movie scores. And things like that, right? So I got a bunch of this Mission Impossible stuff from all those movies and stuff, and maybe some 007. But still, like you, it's nothing that's going to almost get me in like this ultra aggressive state like that, right? I feel more of a sense of elevation and things like that. So that's a big one. Same thing with the consumption of TV, consumption of social media, and the type of things that you see. We don't see it, but over time it saturates in us. It's why you see a lot of kids. It's why I had to deprogram myself from a lot of things growing up, just because you get saturated with it, whether you realize it or not, and it gets stored deep in that subconscious there.
Absolutely.
So that's a huge one. But you know, as we get ready to start kind of wrapping this up here, I want to talk about, I'm curious, what do you enjoy about being a professor?
I love my students. I love my students. It's an understatement. I really, really love my students. And I think the energy that I get back from them, I think they genuinely love me. But knowing that from their physical world, I'm a black professor. Mm-hmm. And most of these students have never even had a black teacher. And they probably never had a professor like me, or they never had a professor with a background like me. But then they have one that is able to create an environment where they feel like it's just as much their environment as mine. And we're able to really share and learn and grow. And I'm able to teach them things about law or HR or leadership. It is just a great experience. So anything I could do, and to see the curiosity, you know, just go off in their minds, how they're just about to go out into the world and do things, or to see when they land that job, or to watch them when they get married or have these fabulous careers. That is the thing that I absolutely love the most. And I think they have made me a better person over the years. I have grown with them, you know, from Iowa State to JMU to here to University of Phoenix. I have grown with these students, and to see how I've matured, you know, I think the students, like students is by far, that's what I love.
How do you think they made you better? You mentioned with lessons and everything. How do you think you've learned? Because somebody could hear, I have some reasons in my head of why, like I have a couple of good friends now that I'm mentoring a little bit, and they're about 20, 21 years old. And it's a unique thing to kind of be in that position now. Because I still think of myself as a little kid, but
yeah.
People go by how long you've been on this earth, right?
Yeah.
So my birth certificate says I've been here 37 years. Yeah. So I'm 37 in them.
Yeah. I would say they made me a better father. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always kids that I look at that I think are making great decisions. And even some of the ones that may not be making the best decisions at the moment for their life, for who they want to be, to hear their advice of why they do what they do, or, you know, and I'm able to share that with my kids, or to realize I give them so much grace. I gave them so much grace. But I didn't give my kids the same grace. And I used to ask myself, why do I give them so much grace, but I don't give my kids? And I realized I got too much expectations on my kids. But in this environment, I'm allowing them to be free, to be who they are, to be curious. And I started asking myself, like the Buddhism philosophy, expectations create suffering. So I'm creating suffering on me and on my kids. So they made me a better parent. They made me a better believer in mankind. you know, to see how passionate and how caring they are about other people, you know, that motivates me to hear them say things that, like, I'm following you and I love what it is that you put out in the world. That motivates me. I think to be able to have so many female students, they created a new respect that I have for females. I'm able to look at females that are absolutely beautiful, but also still be able to see the child in them, you know, and to see that, oh, this is how, you know, older guys are able to manipulate them. So I'm able to share my wisdom, you know, with them. And I think all of those things have helped make me a better person. And, you know, they humble me, you know, just by teaching me things that I don't know, you know, that's going on in their work environment. It's just so many lessons. Those are just some that come to my mind right now.
Yeah. And then I also hear this scripture where, you know, with you, that to whom much is given, much is to be expected. And I think that's kind of, in a nutshell, of kind of what I sense now is that, you know, much has been given to you, much you've acquired a lot, not even just material things, but in spiritual wisdom and insight, right? And there's a greater expectation on you because you know better compared to other people who don't. So for me, as I tell myself, I know a lot of these things. You mentioned the manipulation. We know all these books. We've read all these books. We know how it can be used for bad, but we know how it can also be used for good. And if we choose to go bad, people like us will probably be punished more. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's just kind of my philosophy that I've gathered over the years.
And you know, we could be punished more. I think the punishment really comes from ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, once you know who you are as a person, and I didn't always think this way. I didn't always think this way as a professor. You know, I started being a professor at 32. You know, so the way I think at 43, and I was much wilder at 32 than where I am now at 43, I think things change. And I think I hold myself to a higher, you know, standard. Or I'm aiming, you know, I heard Matthew McConaughey say, I'm always chasing the guy 10 years ahead of me. So I'm thinking, what am I going to be like at 53? You know, that's what I'm chasing. And that's where I'm at in this stage of my life. So I think if I did something that I'm like, first of all, I don't have no weakness in this area no more. And this is not something that motivates me, but I chose to go in this direction. Then that will be the punishment within itself for me, because there are certain things that, you know, anything I do at this stage of my life, I did it because I chose to do it. You know, whether that's so-called good or so-called bad, I decided to do that. There's no alcohol. There's no this. It's me making that decision. So I want to make sure whatever decision I'm making, it's the right decision for me. And spiritually, mentally, and physically, I would be okay with it. So I think that's where I would feel the greatest punishment, knowing that I failed myself. Because, you know, some people could go for years and nothing ever happened to them. And that's fine. If they're cool with that, that's how they want to live. I know what I deal with when I lay in the bed late at night. And I like that I'm able to go to sleep and sleep comfortably knowing I'm just trying to be the best version of me. And I'm happy with who I was today. And that's why I live by the mantra of 86,400 seconds. I'm trying to be my excellence and my best, you know, until I'm laid to rest. So that's my whole mindset.
And so I couldn't stop and not have this question. What inspired you to really start taking your fitness seriously?
Oh man, when I came here in 2014, I was, you know, I got up to 208 and I was about 29% body fat, and I didn't care. I mean, I was eating good. I was like, and I didn't realize I had the waist that I had though. You know what I'm saying? I didn't know that. But I was diagnosed with hypertension and my parents kept saying, well, blood pressure runs in the family and all of this stuff. And I'm like, man, I just don't buy into this. I don't believe it. You know? So I started working out, but my blood pressure wasn't dropping. And then I started watched Forks Over Knives. I read Eat to Live, and I watched What the Health. And all of a sudden, I went vegan for about a month. And then I went vegetarian for about 7-8 months. And I was working out, running incessantly. And I went from 209 till I got as low as 153. And I was right around 12 or 13% body fat. But my wife was, oh, you little, you're small. And I'm like, man, but I, you know, I got abs, right? You know, and then, so I went to that extreme, but then I started working out with some bodybuilders years later. And I really started building on my body and adding muscle. And I didn't really believe, I didn't know the whole, you know, thing about, you know, if you want to lose weight, close your mouth. If you want to lose body fat, you got to eat more. I didn't understand that concept. But when I started understanding macros and started understanding, you know, really strength training and slow cardio, I've been able to get my body up to now. I weigh 183 and I'm 12% body fat. So I have the same cuts that I had at 153. And now I'm just amazed to see what I'm going to look like at 175, 173. I think I'm going to hold on to a lot of muscle. I think this will be the first year I get into the single digits. So I'm excited. I'm excited.
Yeah, I've been across the wide spectrum as well. And the single digits,
it's tough.
Takes a little extra work. Yeah, it takes a little extra work. So I'm going to let you have that. I'm right on the cusp. I would have to stop a lot of my endurance training right
yes,
now.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
That's the hardest thing for it right now is the endurance aspect. So, so one of the last things here is I'm sure a lot of people asked you about getting started. They see a lot of things you're doing, the speaking and all that. And what are things that they should ask you more about when it comes to changing their life?
I think, you know, a couple of things. Why do you want to change your life? And what is it that you're trying to become? And are you really willing to pay the price to be able to know how to adapt this, you know, to adopt this discipline and to make it a daily habit? So I think the why is always the important. You know, for me, I don't want no kids to look at religion or to look at God as this bad thing that's limiting them for how they could truly understand what love is. I don't want nobody to do that because I felt like I was able to be handcuffed for a long time because of that belief. And I understand what my purpose is. My purpose is to try to live the best, the most limitless life that I can so other people can be inspired to do that. And I just feel like, you know, God has given me a lot of different skills to be able to inspire people to do that. And then what, like, I'm here because, man, I want to make sure that I'm changing the way people look at social constructs, mm-hmm. you know, so that's what I believe. What I believe is that we're all the same, you know, we're all one spirit, you know, that are little parts of that extended spirit. And I just try to apply it every single day in my life. So the how, I think, so it's three questions, the why, what, how. I think is the first things that they want to be able to ask themselves and realize if you're not willing to really invest mm-hmm. in yourself and commit to this, don't do it because it's not easy. You know, but Bruce Lee said, don't pray for an easy life. Pray for the strength to be able to handle a difficult life. It's not easy. This is not easy. But if you work hard now, it'll be easy on the back end.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so now for the last question here is someone's going to walk up to you and, you know, let's say since it's campus, somebody's walking up to you. And it's Hodges Library because it's probably my favorite building up there besides the Haslam. And they asked you, what are three things that I could do today to start checking my life and ultimately becoming limitless? And what would you tell them?
I would say, all right, it all starts with how you start your day. You know, when you wake up in a mirror, be grateful. And be grateful and be thankful for the opportunity that you have another opportunity to be in this day. So that's the first thing. So when I get up in bed and I sit on the edge of the bed, I'll be like, man, thank you. I could breathe. Ah, this is going to be a great day. This is going to be a glorious day. And then I tell them to say that, realize today could be your last day. And once you realize that, and if I die today, it's just as good as any other day. And to make it real, anytime you pass a car, you're about 6 inches away from death. A person can have a stroke, a seizure, or whatever, come in your lane, be distracted on the phone. That could be it. So realize it really can happen. So be grateful for that. And then once you move from that, I like to go into the bathroom. I like to throw cold water on my face. And then I like to look at myself and talk all positive things to myself. Boy, you look good. Look at you, boy. You're about to change the world. Right? And I tell myself all of these good things. I hype myself up because you got to be your best hype man or hype woman. You got to love yourself. So once I do that, then I say my mantra. Today is a glorious day. And for 86,400 seconds, I will give my excellence and my best until I'm laid to rest. I'm abundantly blessed and never stressed. Be better than your best and never rest on your last success. Check your life. Be limitless. And then I go out and I attack the day. And I attack the day with what I'm listening to on the way to the gym. And then I go in the gym and I try to destroy my body. And I realize I can always lose in the gym. So the gym always humbled me. And then once I get out of the gym, I start the day and I connect with everybody else. So the first part of your day got to be about yourself, not your cell phone. I don't look at social media. I don't look at my emails. I don't look at texts. I don't do none of that. The first part of my day is about me, because you're your most important person.
I love that. That's a great bookend to this awesome conversation. Man, I really appreciate this conversation. I could probably talk for a couple more hours. There's a lot of things that I had in my notes here that I didn't even get to. So I definitely appreciate that. But maybe next time, if we'll do a part two, we're going to do it in person, and I'll make the return back to Knoxville.
I love that. You got to bring some hot chicken though if you come this way.
I don't like it. It'll be all for you, because you can have all the hot chicken. I don't like it. You can have all that.
You got you. All right.
Yeah, that's all yours. But I'll bring you plenty. Just let me know how much.
Gotcha.
Where can listeners keep up with all your ventures at?
So right now, I actually just changed my website based off what my mentor said. So you can look at me. You can find all of my social media if you go to www.drjamesarthurwilliams.com. You can find all of my information, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, all of those things, Twitter, if you go there.
Awesome to hear. I will have that in the show notes and probably a few other things as well. It's a beautiful website and it's an awesome video. So tell your designer, he did a fantastic job with that.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Julian. Seriously,
yeah.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So awesome job done. So listeners out there, until next time, stay awesome, be limitless, and as always, go be the CEO of your health and your life. Peace.